How is this for a review of a musician? Listen to this. This is from the Gazette of Colorado Springs, Colorado, where they say that the person I am about to talk to on the phone here is a deceiving package. Though young and beautiful, the guitar-playing singer-songwriter sounds like an older woman. Her pop country blend is distinctly adult contemporary in flavor and boasts mature lyrics lovers of folk music will appreciate. Gabrielle Louise's strong voice, which she uses with equal success on stunning high notes and rumbling lows. Wow, you know, that's a career making kind of review right there, and it is all on behalf of the person that we are talking to. She is a 2-time John Lennon Songwriting Contest finalist, and she has already 5 albums out since 2006. Her latest is called Mirror in the Branches, and she will be performing in Denver, in town, on Friday, April 8th. Her name is Gabrielle Louise, and we are thrilled to have her here on UNC Radio. Hello, Gabrielle. How you doing?
Good, Dave. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, that's great. It's great. So you are a local Denver, Colorado-y kind of person, am I right?
Yes, I am a local Coloradan, and very proudly so. I live up in the mountains in Coal Creek Canyon and enjoy the sunshine.
I can't blame you for that. And you're still, even though you've been performing and recording since the mid-2000s, what are you, like 25, 26 years old?
I'm 25, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, wow. How did you get started so early? Was it literally even before high school you started playing and singing? And how did that all start?
Well, my parents were musicians, and my father, I think, wanted to avoid me going into the music industry at all costs, which made me want to go into the music industry at all costs. So it was an early on dream for me. And of course, I think once he saw my obstinance, he fully came into support of that dream. And having 2 musical parents support a musical lifestyle made it really tangible and possible very, very quickly.
Yeah, it's not as if your father was, you know, a lawyer or doctor or something. So no kid of mine is going to showbiz. Your parents are both into showbiz, in a manner of speaking.
Yes.
What kind of musicians are they? What do they do?
Well, my mother's a music therapist. She actually studied at Colorado State University right up the road.
Uh-huh.
And my father played guitar for a country singer for many years by the name of Michael Martin Murphy.
Oh.
And, mm-hmm. Yeah, so both fabulous musicians and fabulous people.
And in your bio on your website, which is, I have that, GabrielleLouise.com, you're one of the things you call them gypsy types. I mean, are they roamers and wanderers? And did they travel
yes.
all your boring life?
Yeah, I went to 12 different schools before I graduated high school.
Good God!
We moved around a lot, yeah. But it was a really fun time, you know, and I learned so much. I got used to making friends really easily and was exposed to such a variety of cultures and landscapes. And I really actually thank them for those experiences.
I mean, because, you know, you talk to a lot of kids who are military brats, and one of the things that they're coping with psychologically for decades is the fact that they were never in one place for more than 3 months.
I'm a musical brat.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, when did you first pick up a instrument?
I think maybe, I think I was a little bit lazy, actually, because both of my parents played. So it wasn't until I was more like 15 that I decided I would like to accompany myself, because as a child, they would accompany me, you know.
Hmm.
So at some point, I think when I was about 15, I decided I wanted to be independent, and that's when I started to learn to play the guitar.
And assumedly, you were very much influenced by the folk and country mode that your folks were in, dealing with Michael Martin Murphy and touring with stuff like that. But how would you say that your music differs from what you heard your parents play all those years?
Well, for a while, Dave, it really didn't. For a while, I loved all of the songs that that my mother had exposed me to, especially the repertoire of Joni Mitchell is still, the first record that you would pull off my shelf. It might be a Joni Mitchell record.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was a huge avid fan of the Beatles, and so I carry those influences with me still. However, recently I started forging into new territory. That song that you just heard, Make You Remember, it tinges on a little bit of, oddly enough, perhaps we'll say rap. So it's maybe like a rap folk blend. So I would say that maybe that's where I started to deviate from them, is just as of late in my more recent explorations musically.
Well, it's a question that I've asked a lot of the musicians that I've interviewed over the past couple of years, of what's on your iPod. I'm always expecting very different answers from the kind of music that they themselves do. So are you listening to rap? Who are you listening to these days?
I listen to a lot of Gillian Welch. And while I don't really play music in the old-time genre, I think that she's a fabulous songwriter and has such a great sense of musicality. Are you familiar with Gillian Welch? She plays with a fellow named David Rawlings.
I don't know Rawlings, but I know a bit of Welch's work, yeah.
But they have beautiful harmonies, and that's something that I've always really appreciated about music, is vocal harmonies. I think they really get you in the gut, you know?
But you are, well, you know, it's funny. I was going to say you're a solo act, but at the same time, anybody who's seen you perform, very often you're not alone up there on stage. What do you have going on? Where did that whole idea come from of putting on a show?
I think it's a bit boring to always do it on your own, you know, so I try to keep a lot of variety in my presentations. More often than not, you could see me performing alongside a fellow named David Reinhardt, who I'm sure we'll get to talking about a little bit later on as well. And David Reinhardt plays guitar and piano, and he sings harmonies, and he's just a wonderful musician and a wonderful songwriter himself. And so it's been really fun to collaborate with him over the last couple of years. Also, I love to perform in a trio configuration with a rhythm section, you know, bass and drums. And over the last year, I've fallen in love with the Argentine tango, and so it's not so odd that you might find a couple of tango dancers dancing on stage to some of the performances.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. There's this whole idea of people come there for, you know, a typical musical folk singer country show, and then suddenly there's two, you know, tango dancers going around the stage. I mean, I think that is pretty cool, and it probably is. I'll bet it's one of the things that when people walk out of the show, the first thing they talk about is, wow, I wasn't expecting that.
You gotta keep people on their toes, right?
Yeah.
I hope to. I hope that life keeps me on my toes. So,
but it's interesting. You've been influenced and obviously fallen in love with tango dance and Carlos Gardel and I guess stuff like that. Has that influenced the sound and the kind of songs that you write and the music that you make, or is it still sort of separate? You know, you'll do your stuff, and then the tango thing is you'll do a more traditional number.
No, I think it's definitely started to bleed through, you know, over the border. I just the other night had the great pleasure of performing for a room full of dancers. So it was an Argentine social dance, and I had been really doggedly preparing these three classic Argentine tango songs. I spent a little bit of time in Argentina this last month studying those.
Oh, wow.
And I've started to kind of verge into that repertoire, but also using some of those very rich, colorful harmonies in my own songwriting and being able to perform some contemporary folk music that has enough, you know, rhythmic similarities and melodic and harmonic similarities to be able to dance the Argentine tango to them, although they are original and maybe more in the folk genre.
Oh, cool. As someone who's been to Argentina many years ago and actually witnessed a couple of tango things, you know, I'm not a dance person, so I would see it and go, okay, that'll look good. And then we would be with people who considered themselves experts, and one couple would get on the dance floor and they'd go, oh, that was fabulous. And then the next couple, they'd be like, they're not so great, and they're kind of amateurs. And I would not remotely see the difference.
Yeah, it's true.
You know,
It's true. It's a beautiful dance, and I think as an outsider looking in, maybe what you mostly pick up on, myself included, you know, I'm a beginner, you know, just the last couple of years I started getting into both the dance and the music. And I think predominantly what you find is this beautiful intimacy between the dancers. It's an improvised dance where in every moment it requires ultimate attention from both the lead and the follow. And so I think as an outsider peering in, you kind of just see that intense focus. And it's beautiful, irregardless of the dancer's level or skill set.
Cool. Let me ask, you know, you're doing a lot of touring and a lot of different places. As I mentioned, you're going to be here back in Colorado on April 8th. But the fact that you are being a musician, you're putting out records, how much of this do you have to do all yourself? It's not like you're backed by a major label. And how much do you have somebody else dealing with booking your tours, doing the promotion, making the CDs or producing and stuff? What percentage of your time is put towards all these different things that a musician has to do?
All of it.
Well, do you actually book yourself as well?
No, I'm very blessed to have different departments, at the end of the day, it's much more than a full-time job. It's like a life passion, you know? And every once in a while I gripe and I get sick and I woke up a bit under the weather this morning from working really hard this week. But I'm really pleased to be able to do something that I care so deeply about, and I think that it's worth it, the hard work on the back end.
Because, you're following, everybody's following that model now. I mean, people who were on major labels 15, 20 years ago are really in the same boat. They are also having to get their own CDs done, having to go out there, get booked, tour themselves, get on the bus, whatever it is, and do it. So at least it's not that big dichotomy between fairly well-known singer-songwriters and performers and folks who are a bit more just starting out. So at least you're kind of in that same boat, you know?
The phone broke up just a little bit there, but I caught the end of it, and I think I do agree with that sentiment.
And you must be pretty prolific because you have five CDs. Well, one of them was an EP, so we'll call it four and a half CDs since 2006. I mean, are you constantly writing songs? Is that the deal?
No, I mean, I do write a fair amount. One of those records also is a live record. So it was a recording of a live concert. But I mean, yeah, I absolutely love to write songs, and I'm going to spend as much time as I can devote to it, doing that. And of course, it is a balancing act from, when you're in the headset of organizing tour logistics, it's more difficult to get creative than when you don't have anything else to attend to. Lately, I've been focused on co-writing with my partner in crime, Chris Carr, a theatrical concert. It's very similar to a musical.
Now, this is a different... Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, this is a different fellow from Ryan Reinhardt that you mentioned earlier. Chris Carr, did you say? Now, partner in crime, is this your personal partner in life or what, or not?
Yeah, he's my personal partner in life, and he's also the co-writer of this musical called The Muses Market that we've both been working on. And David Reinhardt is also featured in The Muses Market. I would say that the three of us really all had a creative hand in it. It features David Reinhardt's music, my music, and Chris Carr is a sustainability speaker, and so it incorporates his instrumental philosophies and ideas, and we sort of toggle between music and it's entertainment, but it's also education. And then we've also incorporated poetry and commissioned a fine artist to create art pieces that serve as characters in the show as well.
So like 100 words or less, because you're giving an idea of what the show is about, but what exactly is the idea of Muse Market and this whole sustainability thing?
So the Muses Market is our attempt at a modern-day Chautauqua, being that we aspire to travel from town to town and present ideas, music, fine art, and poetry in listening spaces. The Chautauqua was a popular concept in the 1920s and was kind of phased out with the advent of radio and television. But we feel that there's a disjunct between what television can provide and what people are desiring to experience today. And so we're hoping to provide some kind of old-school 1920s inspirational sustainability-themed entertainment.
Well, again, also keeping on with this whole sustainability thing, is there something weird, or well, not weird, but something different about your touring van?
Yeah, there is. We've outfitted to run on alternative fuels, specifically biodiesel from a waste vegetable oil source.
Let's take this right from the very beginning, because gas prices are going to go up to probably $4, and people will be like, wait a minute, I can power my vehicle perhaps on vegetable waste. How?
Well, how? Yes. You can take any diesel engine. The diesel engine was actually originally invented to run on peanut oil, which is a vegetable oil.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take it through a simple conversion so that it can run on waste vegetable oil. The exciting thing about that concept is that waste vegetable oil is a recycled fuel. It's something that comes out of the back of a restaurant after it's been used in a fryer to fry French fries or egg rolls or any food like this. And instead of having it go into the garbage, it can be recycled and go into the gas tank. And very typically, restaurant owners will donate it to you. And sometimes, they'll charge, but in the ballpark of maybe $1 a gallon, not $4 a gallon. And so, of course, the economic benefit is tremendous, but beyond that, it's a carbon-neutral fuel, so you don't contribute to the carbon cycle when you burn it. And beyond that, it reduces emissions by 80%. So now, there's a huge environmental benefit.
So when you turn on your van, right, and you get the motor and the engine going, I mean, does it smell like salad?
A lot of people ask this. No, actually it doesn't. And the fume, I mean, if you're in the business of sniffing tailpipes and you were to
sniff, I was sniffing tailpipes when I was younger. There you go. Yeah, oh, it was good stuff.
Like if that's like a hobby and you were to smell a diesel engine, you probably wouldn't enjoy the scent. If you were to smell a biofuels tailpipe, it might reminisce slightly of fuel, but you'd really have to get back in there and up in there to experience that.
Well, actually, regular gasoline doesn't really have a smell. They put smell in there just to keep people from accidentally immolating themselves. You know, the actual fuel itself is odorless.
Well, I didn't know that. You're educating me.
Well, you're educating me on this whole idea. So, but to take, you got a regular van, right, with a regular engine. What did it take to convert the thing so that it would run? I mean, if you were to just pour vegetable oil into a car, you're going to kill your car. So how did you get it converted?
Well, there's a couple of answers to that question. The first one is I do want to say that you can run biodiesel in any diesel engine with no conversion. If you could buy biodiesel that's made from a waste vegetable oil source locally at different biodiesel co-ops. And then that saves the whole work of having to convert your engine. And so it's a really recommendable solution and get the majority of the benefits that we're talking about. The fuel is going to cost a little more because somebody's taken the time to process it for you so that you can put it directly in your engine. On the other hand, if you are interested in outfitting a vehicle to run in straight waste vegetable oil, essentially what you have to do, without getting into boring tech talk, is waste vegetable oil will congeal if it gets too cold. So you need to make sure that the fuel stays hot enough to flow through your fuel system and to flow through the engine. So the way that you do that is by just simply rerouting the coolant lines so that they can keep that fuel warm and from congealing.
If you start your car, if you leave your car overnight in Colorado or Wisconsin, doesn't it just congeal?
Yeah, it will. So, for example, in our vehicle, we've got a heater. We have to turn on the heater 5 minutes before we're going to start the car so that fuel system gets nice and hot before we try to go ahead and turn over the engine.
Is it, if people were to do this in a large way, millions or thousands, millions of people were to do this, would it be sort of like this corn thing that George W. Bush was pushing a couple of years ago, where it seemed like a great idea and a way to get away from dependence on Arab oil, but it actually was not economically feasible? Or is there a way that this could actually be something that millions and millions of people do, as long as lots of people are eating, or eating salads and having restaurant grease?
Right. Well, again, the fuel comes from, it's canola oil, so it's what you might fry French fries or like an egg roll in. But to answer your question, which is a great question, we get it all the time, I believe that we're entering into this kind of new era where there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all solution for the problems that we're facing as a society. Waste vegetable oil isn't going to be, that to say, a one-size-fits-all solution. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I don't think that that means that we shouldn't try to reduce our carbon footprint, you know, that we shouldn't try to be a piece of that puzzle. And I also want to say that it's very distinguishably different from corn, because the biofuel that you create from corn is actually called ethanol.
Right, and, ethanol, that's the word. Yeah.
Yes. So it's actually a different biofuel altogether. It's made through a different process. And I do feel that, so the ethanol thing's kind of a different conversation, but as it pertains to waste vegetable oil grease, I do feel that it will not work for millions of people. But what it does do is pave the way, psychologically speaking, for those that can, the amount of supply that there is. Waste vegetable grease would just go into the garbage can, the amount of it that currently exists. So there's no reason not to use that as a fuel source.
Can I ask you one question? It sounds like a silly question. It is a silly question. But yeah, I've heard for years that Indians use dung to cook with. Is there no way to use poop to run things? There's so much poop.
Goodness.
Can we use cow waste, human waste? It would not smell good, but then again, I live in Greeley, so I'm used to it. Why not? Why not poop?
I wish I had an answer for you there. I'm running out of expertise here. But
we need to get Ed Begley Jr. Like working on that or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
We're talking with Gabriel Louise. I think I should mention that. We've gone from music all the way to these alternative fuel sources. So let's get back to your career and the music and the fact that you do a lot of concerts and touring all over the place. Any great anecdotes and stories from your years on the road, young as you are?
Yeah, absolutely. My favorite part of my job is the touring and meeting so many different colorful characters along the way. You know, you get done with a show and there's some outrageous person there waiting to host you in their home and tell you their life story and you know, potentially be the subject of a new song because they're so fascinating and wonderful. I don't know, maybe my favorite tour story. Well, I'll tell you one that we were musing on this morning over breakfast. We were remembering trying to find a hot spring, you know, in between gigs. It's always nice if you have some downtime to look up if there's a hot spring. And so we had found one in California, and we had spent 2 hours driving over this mountain pass in an attempt to get to this hot spring that some hosts of ours had recommended to us. And after driving on this treacherous dirt washed out road through the mountains past like geothermal plants and all sorts of kooky sites, we came to a gate and the guard there at the gate said, "No, all this land is you know, governmentally owned, and you can't drive through here. You're gonna have to go all the way back down and all the way around the mountain." And you know, we've been already driving for a couple of hours, and we were at probably only 3 miles from the hot spring. It was just on the other side of this gate. And so we thought, "Oh, okay, well, you know, we've been looking for it this long, we'll do it." And so we drove all the way around the mountain, and we arrived at the hot spring. And it was kind of a new agey hot spring, and it turned out it was a nudie hot spring. And it turned out when we walked in, it was, little did we know, the full moon, and they were having this full moon ceremony where nobody was speaking, but everybody was kind of howling at the moon. And we thought, look what we found. This is fascinating.
And did you actually get naked and howl at the moon?
What a question for the air. I'll tell you, we did not howl.
Okay. Well, no, I know half the other ones. Well, I'm sorry, what was that?
I said, and then we proceeded to the next gig. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess after all those years, after stuff like that will happen. I that's part of the joy, I guess, the scrapbook of memories and the unusual things that go on.
Yes, absolutely. It's like you remember the oddest experiences. Maybe not the best and maybe not the worst, just the oddest.
Hey, can I ask, because you've not only been doing your music for 5, 6, 7 years or so professionally, but because you were also with your parents all those times touring, any encounters with idols or real famous singers, celebrities, people that you recall?
Yeah, my parents used to have me backstage at as I mentioned, my dad worked for this country singer named Michael Martin Murphy, and
right.
Michael Martin Murphy hosts this festival called West Fest. I'm not sure if he's still doing it. My father's since retired, but when I was a kid, I remember I would kind of run around backstage, and they'd introduce me to all sorts of characters, and, you know, of course, I had no idea who anybody was. But I was a cute barefoot hippie girl running around backstage, so oblivious to whatever politics were going on above my head. But I remember one time as an adult, I met the fiddle player that played with Joni Mitchell. And to me, that was incredible because Joni Mitchell is like the deity in my universe, you know, so so that was cool.
But have you sung with any people? You've gotten up on stage and or something like that, or not quite yet?
No, I've had the honor of opening for a number of people that I really respect. Guy Clark and Richie Havens both have paved the way in the genre that I'm in.
Oh, you know, off the air, if you can get me a contact number for Richie Havens, because I would love to get him on the show. We had Melanie on here just last week, so you know, I'm in sort of that Woodstock feeling mode. So it'd be great to talk to Richie. Yeah, Richie, like I know him. But what, was he a nice guy?
I could get you his manager's number, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great. I would love that. So can I ask? And I also ask this question of a lot of songwriters. So I'll ask you, Gabriel Luis, when you've written a song, is there an internal meter inside you that tells you it's really special or good or just okay or, you know, good for now, but it wasn't really what you wanted? Or do you have to wait for the audience to tell you?
Wow, what a fabulous question, Dave.
Thank you.
I think it's so different every time that you write a song, where you are psychologically, where you are emotionally. You know, maybe you're writing that song because you're in a low place, or maybe you're writing that song because you're in an exciting headspace and you're traveling and everything's new. And, you know, there's so many different circumstances from which creativity is born. But I think that by and large, when you write a song, if you're kind of humming it all the time, you know, like almost like it's stuck in your own head. It's something called the hum test. I remember reading in a songwriter book at some point. And I think that that's a really valid thing that you have to tune into and listen to because if you can't stop singing your song, you know, probably other people, it's likely that they'll enjoy it. For me, I know it might sound a little harsh and a little hard, but I think I've arrived at a place where I want to share joy with the audience and I want them to enjoy what I'm doing, but I also don't want to put a stop to my own creativity. So if I see the validity in an idea, I'm probably going to choose to pursue it. And then how it's received is just how it's received. Hopefully there's an audience for it somewhere.
Do you get shy or embarrassed? I mean, once you've written a song, is the first person you play it for Carr?
Mr. Carr, yes.
is it Carr with a C or G with a G?
Gar with a G.
It is
Garre. Yeah.
So is he the first person you always turn to, or sometimes do you hold it for yourself and wait for, or you just do it cold in front of an audience for fun? What's your procedure?
Well, I usually do run it by somebody, you know, either my partner or a close friend or a musician I respect, because I always get terrified that, like, you know, what if the song is already written and I'm accidentally ripping somebody off and I don't know about it, you know? There's always that process of kind of making sure that I haven't actually been forging into copywritten material.
You can just call that folk sampling. Nowadays.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, Gabriel Luis, let me tell people a couple of things. First of all, if they're interested in your music, and you have a really wonderful, well put together website. I don't know if you do that yourself or if you have a webmaster. Well, whoever it is, it's real good. So,
thank you.
Go to Gabriel Luis, and that's I-E-L-L-E on Gabriel. It's a female name. GabrielLuis.com. And you can hear a couple of songs on there, lots of really nice pictures. You've got a blog on there, Press Kick, and also all that information we were talking about regarding sustainability and doing things to help the environment, but still make your automobile go. You know, livability and sustainability at the same time. And at the same time, if you want to see and hear Gabriel Luis in the flesh, you've got to be there April 8th. What time does that start?
it's going to start at 7 p.m. We're going to have local food provided, so the actual show will probably start closer to 8. But we've got a local foodist and nutritionist that's going to create some really delicious things for us to eat first.
And this is called the Muses Market. It's in Denver, but where?
It's at Aaron Johnson's Antique Warehouse. And the Muses Market is a sustainability-focused theatrical concert.
Oh, so that's the actual name of the concert, right. It's called The Muses Market in Denver at Aaron Johnson's Antique Place. I guess, again, that'll be on your, I'll make sure it's on your website. Should be. All the your tour information is all there. And you will also be coming back to Colorado. Let's see. You're going to be in, oh, you have it in reverse order. That's kind of interesting. You'll be at the Salida Cafe in Salida in July. And Westcliff. So you do circle back to your home state now and again, which is kind of cool.
Yes, absolutely. It's my favorite place to be.
Well, it's been great having you in our place at University of Northern Colorado Radio, wishing you best of luck with the concert on April 8th, wishing you also wonderful luck with your music and everything that you're doing, and thanking you, Gabriel Louise, for your time.
Dave, thank you so much for having me.